When you build a fence in your backyard, there is this this really comforting expectation of permanence.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like you drive the wooden posts deep into the dirt, you nail up the boards, and you know exactly where your property ends and, where your neighbor's begins.
Right, it's a completely tangible boundary. You can literally lean your weight against it and trust it's going to hold up.
Exactly. It is physical, it's clear, it is indisputable. But then you step into the world of modern technology, and suddenly it feels like we are, we're basically trying to build fences out of smoke.
Oh, I like that. Fences out of smoke.
Yeah, because the lines between what is mine, what is yours, what's public territory, and what is private space, they are just dissolving right in front of our eyes.
They really are.
And today we are looking at this massive technology briefing dated tomorrow, Tuesday, July 14th, 2026. And we are going to explore what happens when inherently borderless technologies completely collide with a world that was, entirely built on physical boundaries.
Yeah, and if there's an overarching theme for you to keep in mind as we unpack these sources today, it's that we are witnessing the exact moments where rapid, just exponential technological advancement completely shatters our legal, political, and even geopolitical frameworks. I mean, the technology is sprinting at a 4-minute-mile pace, and the regulatory rulebook is, well, it's still sitting on the bench lacing up its shoes.
It really is. Okay, let's unpack this. We are starting with the tech that is about to fundamentally change how you interact with arguably the most intimate device in your life, your phone.
Oh boy. Yeah.
The iOS 27 public beta just dropped yesterday, July 13th, and it features this dramatically overhauled Siri AI. I mean, we are finally moving past the era of a digital assistant that, just sets cooking timers and completely misinterprets your text messages.
Thank goodness, because it is a monumental architectural shift for Apple.
Yeah.
For the past decade, Siri basically operated on these rigid pre-programmed decision trees, right? You asked a question, it looked for a matched pattern.
And if it didn't find one,
It just gave up. Or, it punted you to a completely useless web search.
here is what I found on the web for, yeah, we all know that one.
Exactly. But Siri AI is utilizing a large language model trained specifically for the iOS environment. So it actually understands natural language, it retains conversational memory, and most importantly, it can actually reason about context.
And the wildest part of this new context is a feature Apple is calling screen awareness.
This is huge.
It's crazy. Siri can now literally look at what is actively displayed on your phone's screen. So, say you're reading this massive rambling email from your boss about a schedule change, right?
Right.
You don't have to copy and paste anything into a calendar app. You just ask out loud, what time is this new meeting happening? And Siri parses the email on the screen and just tells you.
It's incredible.
Or, like, you're looking at a photo of a dog on a hiking trail in your camera roll. You just ask, what kind of dog is this? And it uses computer vision to identify the breed right then and there.
Just seamlessly.
Yeah. And then we get to the App Intents API.
Which is really the hidden engine powering this entire revolution. An API, or application programming interface, is essentially a universal translator, right? It allows different pieces of software to talk to each other.
So instead of a human finger tapping the glass screen, the AI is using this API to sort of push the digital buttons behind the scenes.
That is the perfect way to visualize it, yeah. Developers map out the functions of their apps so Siri can navigate them invisibly.
Which means, theoretically, you can just say, order my usual from that Thai place and schedule pickup for 7 p.m.
Yes.
And Siri just opens the delivery app in the background, finds the restaurant, pulls up your past order history, sets the time, and processes the Apple Pay checkout.
All without you touching the screen once.
I mean, it is literally filling out forms for you.
Exactly.
But okay, here is my hesitation with all of this. Having Siri AI constantly reading my screen, it feels a bit like someone just standing right over my shoulder, staring at my private text messages and my banking apps.
It's a very valid fear.
Right, because Apple's entire brand identity is built on privacy. So how do they justify this? Are we just, I don't know, accepting constant real-time surveillance for the sake of not having to tap a screen 3 times?
That is the exact tension Apple is trying to navigate right now. And what's fascinating here is how they are balancing this architecturally to avoid that exact surveillance nightmare you mentioned.
Okay, how so?
They're using this highly sophisticated hybrid processing approach. When you ask Siri to do a sensitive task like parsing that private email from your boss, the processing happens entirely on device,
Oh, locally.
locally, handled by the A14 Bionic Neural Engine. It never touches the internet. But if you ask a complex general knowledge query, like, you know, summarize the history of the Roman Empire. The phone knows it lacks the local processing power for that.
Right, because that takes a massive model.
Exactly. So then, and only then, it routes it to Apple's encrypted cloud servers.
I see. So it's making a real-time algorithmic judgment call on where to route the data based on, like, the privacy weight of the task.
Precisely.
But wait, what about the screen awareness thing? Isn't it just beaming literal screenshots of my phone up to the cloud?
No. And this is a really crucial technical distinction. Apple isn't capturing image files of your screen at all.
Okay.
The system generates what they call a semantic description.
A semantic description.
Right. It uses local on-device processing to translate the text, the UI elements, and the layout into a structured, abstracted code that the AI can interpret. Only that mathematical representation is ever used.
Okay, so it's sort of like having someone describe the layout of a room to you over the phone, rather than them texting you a photograph of the room. You get all the information without actually exposing the raw visual data.
That is a brilliant way to put it, yeah.
Okay, that makes me feel slightly better. But there are still some massive technical hurdles here that the beta testers are already flagging.
Oh, absolutely. The latency, for one.
Yes. People are noticing a 2 to 3 second latency on responses. And in the AI world, you know, a 3 second delay feels like an absolute eternity compared to the instantaneous Siri of the past.
It really breaks the illusion of a fluid conversation.
It does. Second, running these LLMs locally is just brutal on the hardware. It's draining batteries about 20% faster.
Ouch.
Yeah. And it still hallucinates or makes factual errors about 15 to 20% of the time.
Which is not great when it's handling your money or your calendar.
Exactly. And then there is the massive controversy. iOS 27 supports 29 different iPhone models, but it completely excludes the iPhone 11.
Which is a device still actively used by, what, hundreds of millions of people globally?
Yes, millions of people. Apple claims this is just a strict hardware bottleneck. They say the iPhone 11 uses the older A13 chip, which simply lacks the advanced neural engine architecture of the A14, so it physically cannot handle the RAM-intensive demands of on-device AI inference.
That's the official line.
Right. But I have to wonder if that's the whole truth. I mean, is the exclusion of the iPhone 11 a genuine, insurmountable technical limitation? Or is this just cynical, planned obsolescence?
It's a fair question.
Because they could have just offered a cloud-only, maybe degraded version of Siri AI for older phones. But they explicitly chose not to do that.
It certainly forces the consumer's hand, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You either pony up for a brand new upgrade, or you accept that a perfectly functional, widely used device has artificially reached its end of life for major features.
Yeah.
And it highlights something much larger, actually. It shows just how fiercely Apple is protecting and controlling its closed software ecosystem. They want absolute uniformity in how this AI performs across the board.
And they're willing to sacrifice older devices to maintain that absolute control over their walled garden.
Completely.
But that walled garden is exactly what OpenAI is currently trying to tunnel under, which naturally leads us to this massive 127-page lawsuit Apple filed against OpenAI just a few days ago on July 10th.
Yeah, this is shaping up to be one of the most significant intellectual property disputes of the decade.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Primarily because it blends traditional hardware theft with the new AI arms race.
The allegations in this briefing are intense. Apple is suing for straight-up trade secret theft. Two highly senior former Apple engineers, Cheng Liu and Tang Tan, they left the company in 2024 to join OpenAI.
Right.
And now, these weren't just low-level software guys. They were pivotal in custom silicon design for the Apple Watch and the iPhone. They had access to future product roadmaps years in advance.
The crown jewels of Apple's hardware division.
Exactly. And they jumped ship to work on OpenAI's highly secretive project Device X, which is reportedly this standalone AI-powered personal device.
A hardware pivot for OpenAI.
Right. And Apple claims that in the weeks right before these engineers resigned, they transferred over 400 proprietary files to personal cloud accounts. We're talking detailed circuit schematics, thermal simulation data, and mechanical CAD drawings. And today, there are over 400 former Apple employees working at OpenAI.
It is a staggering migration of elite engineering talent. Just a massive brain drain.
It is. But I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
Silicon Valley was basically built on talent mobility. I mean, California law notoriously prohibits non-compete agreements for this exact reason. So ideas and innovation can flow freely, right?
Sure.
Apple famously poached top chip designers from Intel to build their incredible M-series computer chips. When you hire an expert, you hire their brain. So why is the situation with OpenAI any different from Apple taking Intel's talent?
It's a great point, but the distinction lies between human capital and intellectual property.
Okay, unpack that.
When Apple recruited from Intel, those engineers brought their learned skills, you know, their generalized knowledge of semiconductor physics, and their expertise in chip architecture. What Apple is alleging OpenAI did crosses a very rigid legal line.
Because of the files?
Yes. They're alleging the systematic extraction of institutional memory alongside literal proprietary CAD files and thermal data. To use an analogy, it's the difference between hiring a master chef because they know how to perfectly sear a steak versus hiring a chef who literally photocopied the secret recipe book from his last restaurant and brought it into your kitchen.
Okay, yeah, that makes total sense. I imagine OpenAI's defense is just going to be that great minds think alike, right? That there are only so many ways to build a thermal envelope for a microchip before the physics force you into a similar design.
You have anticipated their exact legal strategy.
Really?
Yeah. OpenAI is arguing convergent design. Their defense is that any similarities between Apple's hardware and Project Device X are entirely coincidental, stemming from just public domain knowledge and the unforgiving laws of physics.
The law of physics, yeah.
When you are trying to cram a highly advanced heat-generating AI processor into a pocket-sized device without literally melting the battery, there are only so many optimal thermodynamic solutions. Two independent engineering teams will naturally arrive at nearly identical designs.
That's a clever defense. But stepping back from the court filings for a minute, the strategic reality here is just fascinating. OpenAI, a software company famous for ChatGPT, is attempting a massive pivot into hardware.
Huge pivot.
Sam Altman has reportedly teamed up with former Apple design guru Joni Ive, the guy who designed the iPhone to build this device X. Why? Because right now, OpenAI is totally reliant on Apple and Google to reach users on mobile.
They're renters on Apple's property.
Exactly. If OpenAI creates a compelling standalone device that seamlessly integrates with their AI, they bypass the App Store entirely.
It is an existential threat to Apple's entire profit model. I mean, if you don't control the hardware, you simply don't control the user.
Right.
So while Apple's lawsuit might be about trade secrets on paper, strategically, this is a maneuver to tie OpenAI up in incredibly expensive, time-consuming litigation.
Ah, to slow them down.
Yes. It forces OpenAI to freeze their hardware development while the courts sort out the IP claims, which conveniently buys Apple the exact time it desperately needs to refine its own Siri AI models.
Wow. So Apple is relying on traditional physical property-based trade secret laws, laws written decades ago to fight a modern battle over AI dominance.
Which really proves how outdated our traditional court systems are when dealing with new tech.
It really does. Which makes you wonder, what if a government just decided to build a brand new legal system from scratch, explicitly designed for the architecture of new technology?
Well, enter the state of New Hampshire.
Yes, enter New Hampshire.
This is a textbook example of policy proactively trying to match the pace of technology rather than, you know, retroactively punishing it.
And it is worth noting here for you listening, because it is so central to why this is happening in New Hampshire, of all places, that the state has this very pronounced live free or die libertarian culture.
Very much so.
Now, just to be clear, whether you think that approach is the ultimate model for economic freedom or a recipe for a deregulated disaster, that isn't the point of our deep dive today. We are not endorsing these political viewpoints or taking a side on right-wing versus left-wing economic policies. We are strictly reporting on the legislative choices outlined in our briefing.
Right. We are looking at the architecture of the policy itself.
Exactly. So let's break down exactly what House Bill 679 actually does. The governor just signed it into law on July 13th, making it the most comprehensive state-level blockchain regulation in U.S. history.
It is sweeping.
First, it explicitly legalizes cryptocurrency mining and blockchain validation without any need for special state licenses.
Big deal on its own.
Right. But second, and far more radically, it establishes a specialized blockchain dispute court within the state judicial system. And crucially, it formalizes a strategic Bitcoin reserve. New Hampshire is now holding 3,250 Bitcoin. That is roughly $200 million. Or about 5% of the state's public funds, acting as a state-sanctioned inflation hedge.
It is a massive, highly calculated economic experiment.
It really is. But here is where it gets really interesting for me, the specialized courts. asking a traditional 65-year-old municipal judge to rule on a decentralized smart contract. It feels a bit like asking a French teacher to grade an advanced calculus exam.
Yes, or like asking a real estate lawyer to mediate a property dispute inside World of Warcraft.
Right. The fundamental physics of the universe they operate in are just totally different. A smart contract is just self-executing code on a blockchain. Mm-hmm. It doesn't care about human intent. It only cares about the math.
Exactly.
So having judges who actually understand cryptography makes total sense, but I have to push back on the execution here.
Okay, what's the concern?
Aren't we risking massive regulatory capture? If these new judges only hang out with crypto bros and developers and they spend all day immersed in the blockchain ecosystem, won't they just become inherently biased toward protecting the industry rather than the consumer?
It is a very valid concern, and it strikes at the very heart of how we design judicial infrastructure. The closest parallel we have right now is the specialized patent court system in the U.S.
Oh, true.
Those judges develop incredibly deep technical expertise in complex innovation disputes. They understand the nuances of biotechnology, semiconductor patents, all of it.
Which is helpful.
So it makes them highly effective and efficient, yes.
Right.
But they are also constantly scrutinized for being overly sympathetic to massive tech corporations.
Right.
New Hampshire is willingly taking on that risk of bias because of the potential economic upside. They are operating under the classic American political concept of states acting as laboratories of democracy.
Meaning they take the massive risk so the rest of the country can just sit back and watch what happens.
Precisely. In a federal system, individual states can experiment with policies that would be far too risky to implement nationally right away. I mean, New Hampshire is placing a $200 million bet on a highly volatile asset class.
It's wild. Traditional state treasuries invest in safe, boring things like municipal bonds or federal treasuries.
Right. Bitcoin, on the other hand, has swung wildly between $58,000 and $74,000 in just the last 3 months.
So if Bitcoin tanks by 30%, the state literally loses $60 million in taxpayer wealth overnight.
Yes. But the 5% cap is designed to sort of limit that catastrophic contagion. And if New Hampshire's gamble works and they attract a massive influx of tech investment and see their portfolio grow,
other states will jump in.
Exactly. States like Wyoming, Texas, and Florida, who already have similar drafts in committee, by the way, they will immediately pass their own versions.
Yeah.
And if half the states in the country suddenly build their own sovereign crypto economies, it will force a sluggish federal government to finally write a cohesive national framework.
So New Hampshire is trying to create economic freedom on Earth by completely rewriting the rule book.
Right.
But meanwhile, SpaceX is trying to completely rewrite the economics of the literal final frontier. And just as we are seeing state laws colliding with federal laws in New Hampshire, we're seeing intense national rivalries colliding in the vacuum of space.
The sheer scale of the orbital infrastructure being deployed right now is just staggering.
Let's talk about Thursday evening. SpaceX is set to launch Starship Flight 13. But this isn't just another explosive test flight. This is their first true operational mission.
Right, they're carrying actual payload.
Exactly. They're carrying a payload of Starlink version 3 satellites. This represents a $2 billion investment. These new satellites are designed to create a mesh network in low Earth orbit utilizing inter-satellite laser links.
Lasers in space.
Basically, instead of a satellite bouncing a signal down to a ground station on Earth, which then bounces it to another satellite, these satellites just shoot lasers at each other in the vacuum of space.
Incredible.
And because light travels faster in a vacuum than it does through glass fiber optic cables on Earth, we are talking about global download speeds of 1 gigabit per second with almost zero latency.
Anywhere on the planet?
Anywhere. But to get this payload to orbit, we have to look back at the anomaly during Flight 12.
Ah, yes. Flight 12 was what the aerospace industry politely calls a highly educational failure.
Highly educational. I love that. So 4 minutes into Flight 12, right as the rocket hit max Q, which is that brutal aerodynamic window where the vehicle is fighting the absolute maximum atmospheric pressure as it punches through the sky, they suffered an uncontrolled burn in Engine 7.
Right.
It forced an emergency shutdown of the entire vehicle. Telemetry later showed it was a thermal management issue in the regenerative cooling system.
Which is such a tricky system to get right.
From what I understand in the briefing, regenerative cooling is when they pump the rocket's own super chilled liquid methane fuel through the walls of the engine bell to keep the metal from melting before routing that same fuel into the combustion chamber to be burned.
Yes. It is a brilliant design, but incredibly delicate.
Right. Because if it fails,
It requires an astonishing level of fluid dynamics and thermal precision. If the fuel flow fluctuates for even a millisecond, the engine bell simply melts under its own exhaust heat.
But the briefing notes that version 3 of Starship actually fixes this. They redesigned the cooling channels to improve flow rate, upgraded the thermal sensors for faster reaction times, and they actually bumped the thickness of the rocket's stainless steel skin from 3 millimeters to 4 millimeters.
Just to increase its thermal mass during atmospheric reentry.
Right. Plus, they installed the new Raptor 3 engines, which deliver 15% more thrust while being physically lighter. If Flight 13 succeeds and they achieve full, rapid reusability, it drops the cost of putting mass into orbit from about $28 million a launch down to under $2 million.
Which fundamentally alters the economics of human space access. It makes building massive orbital structures financially trivial.
It really does. But here is the bizarre contrast that I wanted to bring up. Simultaneously, just 2 days prior to this cutting-edge Starship launch, NASA astronaut Dr. Anil Menon launched the International Space Station on Tuesday. But he didn't fly on a reusable Starship or even a SpaceX Falcon 9.
No, he doesn't.
He launched from a pad in Kazakhstan on top of a Russian Soyuz MS-29 rocket.
This is one of the most fascinating geopolitical juxtapositions of our time.
And look, just to pause again for the listener, terrestrial politics are incredibly fraught right now, especially between Washington and Moscow following the 2022 invasion of Ukraine.
Absolutely.
We are impartially reporting the diplomatic realities discussed in the source without taking any political sides regarding international conflicts. But it is wild to look at how those very real, very hostile, earthbound tensions seem to completely morph the second you hit orbital velocity.
They really do.
If SpaceX is dropping launch costs to $2 million and they're building the most capable, advanced rocket in human history right here in America, why on earth is NASA still putting an American astronaut on a 50-year-old Russian rocket design?
I don't know. It seems entirely counterintuitive when you look at the massive technological gap between the two. But if you connect this to the reality of space exploration, you realize that in high stakes, lethal environments, practical survival, and scientific cooperation will always trump terrestrial politics.
As so.
The Soyuz rocket is essentially the ultimate orbital lifeboat.
Because it's just so simple and durable.
Exactly. Space is an inherently hostile environment that is trying to kill you at every moment. You always, always need a reliable way home. The Soyuz spacecraft uses older chemical propellants that are incredibly stable, meaning it is certified to stay docked to the International Space Station for a full year without degrading.
Wow, a full year?
Yes. SpaceX's Crew Dragon, on the other hand, while packed with highly advanced touchscreens and modern life support, it uses complex propellants that begin to degrade after about 6 months in the radiation of space.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So NASA intentionally cross-trains its astronauts on the Soyuz so that in a catastrophic emergency, any crew member can fly the lifeboat home regardless of what flag is stitched to their spacesuit.
That makes total sense.
Russia needs the hard currency and the political prestige of hosting NASA astronauts, and NASA needs the unmatched 50-year safety record of the Soyuz as an insurance policy. It proves that despite economic sanctions and fierce political rhetoric, raw survival just forces cooperation.
But that era of forced cooperation is actually coming to an end in just a few years, isn't it?
It is. The International Space Station is really showing its age, and current plans have it operating only through 2030. After that, it will undergo a controlled, fiery deorbit and plunge into the Pacific Ocean.
The end of an era.
And the crucial takeaway here is that it won't be replaced by a single, unified international symbol of post-Cold War peace.
It's being replaced by commercial real estate developers.
Essentially, yes. NASA is transitioning to a contractor model. Axiom Space is building commercial modules that will eventually detach and become their own station. Blue Origin is developing the Orbital Reef, which is designed as a mixed-use business park for research and space tourism.
A business park in space.
Yeah. Meanwhile, China has already deployed its own fully operational national space station, Tiangong, largely because they were historically excluded from the ISS by the U.S. Congress.
Right.
India has announced they want their own station by 2030 as well. So we are moving away from a shared international outpost toward a highly fragmented, fiercely competitive environment of national outposts and corporate space stations.
Wow. So what does this all mean for you listening? If you zoom out and look at the tapestry of everything we've talked about today, from Siri AI suddenly having the intelligence to read your screen and independently take actions across your apps, to multi-trillion-dollar corporations suing each other over stolen hardware blueprints because AI is getting too hot to cool, to a small state like New Hampshire unilaterally rewriting its laws to stockpile Bitcoin, to the literal fragmentation of our presence in orbit. We are watching society scramble in real time to build fences around technologies that, by their very nature, are designed to break boundaries.
The fences are made of smoke.
Made of smoke.
And synthesizing all of these sources leaves us with a truly profound, slightly unsettling implication to consider.
Okay, lay it on us.
We've established today that Siri AI is gaining the agency and the APIs to act across applications on your behalf. We've established that New Hampshire is giving explicit legal protection and judicial clarity to blockchain validation and decentralized smart contracts.
Right.
And we know Starlink is about to blanket the globe in gigabit laser-linked satellite internet that completely ignores national borders.
The pieces are all connecting into a single infrastructure.
They are. So, how long until your personal AI assistant can legally open its own crypto wallet, execute its own smart contracts to generate revenue, and use those funds to buy its own Starlink bandwidth so it can operate entirely independently of you?
Oh, wow.
When artificial intelligence transitions from being a tool we use to becoming the primary autonomous user of our digital and economic infrastructure, who exactly does the law hold responsible when something inevitably goes wrong?
Whoa. That is terrifying, and based on the tech we just discussed, entirely possible. When the technology is moving this fast, we simply cannot afford to just be passive consumers anymore. We have to understand the invisible fences being built around us and who is holding the hammer. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the tech around you, keep looking for where the boundaries are shifting, and most importantly, keep an eye on those fences before they disappear entirely. See you next time.